Sounds like it.
Hey, Chair announces presence of a forum. We'll get started today. Patricia, would you please begin with a safety briefing?
Good morning. Welcome to the Natural Resources Building. At this time, I ask that you silence any noise-making devices that you have. In the event of a fire, the alarms will sound and flash. Please leave this room using the double doors in the front of the room. In the event of an earthquake, alarms may not sound and flash. Please drop to the floor, cover your head as best as you can, or go under a table. After the shaking has stopped, leave this room using the double doors in the front of the room. In any evacuation of the building, staff will lead you out using the double doors in the front of the room, out the first door on the left, and out towards Jefferson Street. There, DNR employees are trained and equipped to assist you in checking in and responding to any emergencies. Thank you.
Thanks. Our first item of business is general public comment period. We have folks from the public wishing to comment. Rob Cavanaugh.
My name is Rob Cavanaugh, and I was confused yesterday when you said you were going to carry on the Western Gray School conversation to today. And so I was going to come back today to talk about it, but they've already made a decision, so anything I would say is moot. And I wouldn't waste your time with it. I would just ask that you use the testimony, written testimony that I gave yesterday for my comments. What I wanted to say today was, as far as I understand, and from the records I've obtained and the investigation that I've completed, Commissioner Goldmark has done every possible thing I could have asked him to do, and I did ask him, and he did cooperate, to prevent future deaths and damage to property from landslides. And so I would like to thank the staff that did such a great job and coming up with new ways to prevent tragedies like that from happening in the future. And I hope to be able to come back this afternoon when there'll be more people here talking about their experiences and their aspirations. I should tell you that I've asked the Attorney General of the United States to conduct a grand jury investigation into criminal liability of persons who I believe caused the deaths of 43 people. That cannot be corrected by the goodwill of DNR. You've done what you can do. But there has to be justice for those 42 dead people. And I'm sure you would agree with that. So thanks a lot.
Karen Terwilliger.
Good morning, Chairman Everett and members of the board. My name is Karen Terwilliger. I'm the Senior Forester for Washington Forest Protection Association. And I see that on the agenda that there will be a lot of discussion today about unstable slopes. I just wanted to give a little preface and overview of that information from our perspective. First off, I think we all need to be mindful of the legal requirements that we have in the forest practices arena to not increase the rate of landslides in hazard areas. That's very important in the process moving forward. Secondly, along with Mr. Cavanaugh, I'd also like to commend the work of DNR policy and the technical folks that have worked on this over the past few months. There's been a lot of work done, and you're going to see the results of that work today in terms of how we're addressing your motions. And three specific items that I think are important in today's discussion. First, I think you're going to see that there's a broad array of tools available for landowners, reviewers, and regulators to take a look at the land forms that we have here in Washington State and identify and delineate those landforms that are dealing with glacial deep-seated landslides. I think today you're going to see a more comprehensive set of tools that you did in May, primarily because there was just so much information that you had to look through during the May meeting. And so I think it's important to keep in mind that there is a broad array of tools. Secondly, there's been a lot of preliminary work done now on this rulemaking process as well as a board manual discussion. And I think now is the time that we increase the transparency and really be more inclusive of the process. Stakeholders have not had a chance to review some of those documents, and I think it's appropriate time to start that process at this point. The TFW process has many strengths. One of them is bringing together a whole lot of people that are highly educated, highly experienced in these areas to vet information and be able to provide comments to the Department of Natural Resources, Forest Practices Board, and policy about how things move forward in terms of legal issues as well as implementation. And I think that this issue and these documents are too important not to do this process right. Third issue has to do with LIDAR, and one of the motions that y'all made during the May meeting was to have DNR talk to landowners and WFPA about the potential for providing or sharing LIDAR resources that landowners may have. And I just wanted to say several things about that. Those discussions have been ongoing. First thing is that WFPA has encouraged our members to provide the appropriate information in developing their individual forest practices applications, including where appropriate, you know, clipping the LIDAR pieces to go along with it. Secondly, we have encouraged our members to participate in the consortium dealing with LIDAR, as well as other collaborations in terms of getting LIDAR available. Third, WFPA strongly supports a budget request from Department of Natural Resources, Governor's Office, counties, to enhance the level of LIDAR that we have in the state. And we are ready, poised and ready to help on that issue. And then fourth, we are also in the process of facilitating discussions between DNR and individual landowners. WFPA itself is a trade organization. We don't own LIDAR, but it's an investment decision that each company makes. And we have asked that DNR and individual companies work together on those issues. And the companies that I've talked to are interested in at least having that discussion. So thank you. That's going to be a long day, but I think it's going to be very productive.
First item of business is to, our second item of business, is to check in with policy as to the status of the recommendations that were signed by the board at the May meeting. So Adrian and Stephen, would you please come join us? I know we have a couple of other presenters. While you're getting situated, board members, in your day of packet in an effort to help you manage the usual difficult and complex amount of information, there is a one-page table of action status summary on each of the board motions that were assigned. So please, that helps you to follow that along today. It's in yesterday's paper.
Well, good morning. I guess we can just go a quick round of introductions for the record. My name is Adrian Miller. I work for Olympic Resource Management and I serve as co-chair, of course, to the TFW policy.
Good morning. I'm Kurt Belthusen. I am the director of the Forest and Fish Program for the Skagit River System Cooperative, which is a tribal organization. I'm here today because I'm a participant in the policy committee and the technical subgroup.
Stephen Burnett, Department of Ecology and Co-Chair of Policy.
Good morning, Isabel Sarikhan, DNR Forest Practice Engineering Geologist.
Well, I'm going to lead this off with a little bit of a context setting for kind of how we're going to present the information today. We've got sort of four key bullets identified in the agenda. In addition to sort of setting us up, Stephen and I will kind of focus on the first bullet around the process review and give you an update on where we're at with that. And then Isabel will be presenting some information about the portions of the board motions relating to gaps in information. And Kurt's got a couple of presentations. Focusing on the last two bullets and looking at mitigation measures and also talking about the research. Stephen and I will also be sort of introducing each one of those, again, trying to set a little bit of context and show how these, you know, policies, actions, and what we're working on are interacting with, you know, DNR-administered processes as well as other external processes. So to begin, you know, since the May Forest Practice Board meeting, policy developed a plan that we went through with policy in our June meeting to really outline how we were going to respond to the board motions and get some general agreement on the direction. And so we've done that and have begun to implement that plan. Part of that consisted of sort of breaking this apart into pieces so that we could manage it more efficiently in a more timely manner. And that was sort of creating a subgroup of DFW policy of those caucuses that were interested in actively participating in those ongoing discussions. And also a technical subgroup. There's a lot of information and a lot of specific expertise that's required to be able to make good decisions in response to board motion. Those groups are meeting independently of our standard policy meetings. We've scheduled several additional meetings in order to move this forward. We've had three technical group meetings and two policy subgroup meetings. We actually have a policy subgroup meeting scheduled for tomorrow in anticipation of any response or redirection from the board. So I think we're pretty well poised to be able to address the board's motions. And with that context, I think I'll move into the first bullet, which is looking at the process review. And this is something that is not the most most intellectually interesting part of the kind of work we do, but I think it's probably one of the most important. We rely on processes and procedures to ensure that the rules are being implemented correctly. That happens both on landowner side, that happens when we have external reviewers, and it also happens when we have agency reviewers. And I did think it's important to remind the board that this has actually been an ongoing process. We have been reevaluating our approach to managing landslide risk continually over time. This goes back not years, but decades of continual improvement and refinement of these policies and procedures. Most notably, in response to the 2007 storm event, there was a study, the Mass Waste Effectiveness Project, and part of the recommendations out of that project was to do exactly what the board directed us to do. And so, in a way, the board actually affirmed actions that were already ongoing. And there's a couple key pieces of that I'd like to highlight and remind the board again that I think are significant in the context of glacial deep-seated landslides specifically. The first part of that was a request by caucuses that the Department of Natural Resource fully outlined their internal review process so that we could essentially see, the collective, the public, all TFW participants could see and understand the steps that the agencies take in reviewing forest practice applications for landslide risks. And that's been completed. And that was presented in a series of couple day presentations and also has been documented in a pretty extensive flow chart that I believe the board has been provided. The second piece is also a change in the form, and again, not the most incredible thing to see, but what that form does is very important, in that it documents what landowners are doing. And this is important for a couple reasons. One is it's a way to check and ensure that landowners are doing what they say they're doing. But more importantly, from my perspective, it provides a great screening tool for outside agencies, the Department of Natural Resources, outside stakeholders, to look and see what the level of review by the landowner with respect to mass wasting really is on an application-by-application basis. And it actually requires that landowners document where they look in the field, what screening tools they utilize. And there's a wide range that we're going to get into. You can do a whole lot of advanced screening, or you could walk through the unit and everything in between. And so I think requiring that documentation so that people can see the degree to which landowners are looking at it, or in the event that landowners aren't looking at it sufficiently, it provides an opportunity for DNR to request additional information or target that area for a more intense review. So those are sort of ongoing things. And you know, we've been looking at a lot of smaller process adjustments throughout that conversation. What I guess I would say in terms of sort of, you know, sort of outstanding concerns that that the co-chairs are hearing from policy, I really sort of look at two things that we continually hear related to process that I don't believe have fully been addressed in a couple different forums. And that is the delineation of groundwater recharge areas, you know, essentially where is the line. The other part that we continually hear concerns about within the context of sort of process is, you know, how deliverability is assessed. And I'm flagging these because I don't want to imply that, you know, everything's completely rosy in policy land, but I want to point out, and I think the board is keenly aware, that those specific issues have been tasked to a board manual group within the Department of Natural Resources. And so that's one of those sort of parallel processes that policy participants are watching. And my perception, and I think my co-chair's perception, is that before policy is sort of willing to say, okay, we're satisfied with the process, they'd like to see what those pieces of that process look like. And so at some point, we're going to kind of have to bring this work together and talk about it as a group. And at that point in time, I think we'll have a much better assessment of kind of where people are falling out. One last little process-related thing that I think is important to flag, and Isabel will touch on this in her conversation. There's a recognition early on that as we looked at the different screening tools in the gap analysis, that list being put in one place would be very valuable to landowners and to reviewers. And so the department essentially picked that up and took that over into the board manual discussion. So I expect some of that work from that policy subgroup is already actually being sort of transferred into the board manual discussion. And I think that's an important addition to that board manual work. So I think I've covered the bulk of the process pieces. I guess the one remaining thing that I probably should highlight in terms of, and it's in the same vein as the board manuals, you know, DNR also has a rulemaking process in place that's addressing information requests to landowners. And again, I think seeing the 0102 language hopefully will sort of build confidence in addition to the board manual that you know, you've got a rulemaking, you've got a board manual, and you've got some policy review actions collectively, you know, are those sufficient to address the concerns that policy members may have in response to the board's motion. So I'll pause there, and then maybe we could entertain some process questions, and then we can move on to the other segments.
Questions from board members?
Is this a good time to talk about the forms that are on our table for process, or is that going to come?
I think the after lunch discussion might be the better place to ask about the form and content. Hearing none, proceed.
Okay, so the second bullet of this agenda is all about information gaps, and so we're going to have Isabel talk about that and where we are in our analysis.
All right, let's see if I can just talk to the microphone. All right, so in front of you, one of the sheets that you've had handed out is this very long sheet right here. This is a list of compiled list of screening tools that average person in the or anyone can essentially access for public that is doing management activities within the forest environment. A lot of this is very geologically minded. So these are screening tools that we'd use to screen out unstable slopes, landslides, and the like. So just kind of to quickly go through the list on how it's set up. It's split up into different sort of reference materials where you would have like LIDAR, DNR map layers. This is primarily GIS related stuff. It flips over into a second side if you haven't figured that out yet. And then we have some other, down at the very bottom, field visits, stereophotos, orthophotos, stuff that, well, orthophotos would be GIS, but stuff that might not be GIS accessible, but other tools that might not be computer-based. On the very right-hand side, this is a website link, and we also, in the very center of the form, essentially is who can access this sort of data. So much of this data is readily available and accessible by the public, or anyone that would like to access this data. And there's a few issues that we kind of ran across that we felt, that there is some limited access, such as stereo photos, aerial photo pairs, can be fairly limiting for people to be able to access. And also field visits can sometimes be restrictive based on permission of landowners to go on private property. But past that, the vast majority of this is accessible by the public. Through the policy meeting, we kind of came up onto 3 points. Based on the analysis that identified the locations where glacial deep-seated landslides could occur and where existing public LIDAR is available, it appears that roughly 20 to 25% of the locations where glacial deep-seated landslides could occur do not currently have publicly available LIDAR. The Technical Subcommittee of Policy agrees that prioritizing these areas for LIDAR acquisition will help in identifying glacial deep-seated landslides. In the areas that are primarily where glacial deep-seated landslides could occur that we don't have existing public LIDAR, during the investigation I found is primarily Okanagan, parts of Stevens County, and Ponderay County is the vast majority of that area. While LIDAR is an important tool, access to current and historical stereo air photos are as important as the best topographic maps in identifying glacial deep-seated landslides. So this is a tool that geologists and use a lot, primarily before the advent of LIDAR was invented, where we could take out photos and we could put them into a viewer to make them look 3D, to look at the topography in that respect. During our discussion, it became clear that there are several barriers in accessing air photos by landowners, reviewing agencies, and non-agency review participants. The Technical Subcommittee of Policy agrees that access policies be reviewed and changed if necessary to provide better access by the public. DNR does have a fairly extensive air photo list, and it's not always clear how the public can access that, or even if the public can at times access that. So part of the talk from the Technical Subcommittee of Policy was to see if DNR could re-look into that to see if we can find a clearer way for public to be able to potentially access those air photos. An additional tool used by professional geologists are published maps of geologic features from multiple sources that include deep-seated landslides. Based on analysis that identified the locations where deep-seated landslides could occur and where existing published maps of deep-seated landslides are available, it appears about roughly 40% of locations where deep-seated landslides could occur are not mapped, and there are other areas that possibly could need to be remapped. The Technical Subcommittee of Policy agrees that if recommendations 1 and 2 are complete, it would make sense to aggregate this information to a single layer for glacial deep-seated landslides and subsequently prioritize areas for any additional mapping or map refinement. And I think that just about covers it all.
Were you just reading something in front of us, or is that something?
What?
Were you just reading from something in front of us? I was trying to find that.
I don't know. I use my speaker notes.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's I could sort of address that point, and I should have maybe made this as part of my overarching comments. You're getting essentially a preview of what the policy group tomorrow is going to be hearing in their report from the technical committee. So I think it's important to emphasize that I would say nearly everything we're saying is works in progress that hasn't been fully vetted and voted on by consensus.
but we think there's, you know, enough support and they're pretty common sense that, that I don't envision a whole lot of controversy around these sorts of decisions. But whether this is the total set of recommendations that might be coming back from policy, it is premature to do that. And that's why we haven't presented something formally beyond our speaking.
There was just a lot of information flowing there.
Yeah.
And try to figure out if I'm supposed to respond to it or process it or what I'm supposed to do with it.
Yeah. Well, let's have a little discussion around it, and we can all sort of do that together. So let's go back to the last point I think I recall you having made was 40% or so of the areas that are somewhat likely to have glacial deep sea landslides are not don't have mapping.
Yes, we don't have existing
polygons.
We don't have existing maps that show where those landslides might be occurring on the landscape. Yeah.
And so, can you help the board understand the process that would be required to go through that kind of hazard mapping? What is actually done? How long does that sort of thing actually take? Figure out what that means a little bit.
There's a few different ways to map deep sea landslides. Of course, we've kind of talked about LIDAR a lot. LIDAR is a very great tool at identifying LIDAR. This would be primarily partially a literature search to see what existing data is there, and that would need to be digitized into GIS. If we had LIDAR available, we'd probably remap a lot of the areas that had earlier mapping just to make sure the boundaries are adequately mapped now that we have better data that we can constrain where those boundaries may be.
Is it months or years or what? I mean, how kind of resource are we talking about?
We were looking at various possibilities on the timeline. Yeah, he's not paying attention. I think it was.
Kurt may be able to add some color to that one.
Yeah, the comment I wanted to make was that the presentation that I'll give you later is going to give you an overview of some of the different proposals, including the one Isabel was talking about. So okay. It'll provide kind of a little bit higher elevation look at that.
The other thing I would add is that part of the Forest and Fish Agreement was doing something called the Hazard Zonation Project. That project ran out of funding about 6-8 years ago, and what you're hearing about is where there's still gaps that mapping needs to take place. Now, whether we would, as Isabel portrayed, use new tools to do some of that mapping, it would still take some on-the-ground work at some point to actually go out and look at these things. You might use new tools to actually find them and so forth, but eventually to look at stuff on the ground is always one of the best ways to look at these things.
And maybe to sort of conclude this part of the presentation, you know, when you look at this suite of tools, you know, there's a lot here, and in different areas we've got different kinds of LIDAR, different areas we've got different kinds of maps, and really you could look at this as sort of a layer cake of different screening tools that may be available, and what the recommendations you're hearing are that you know these are sort of the obvious places that if we were going to sort of fill in some of those layers, that's where we would go first. You know, I think it's important to understand that you know, just because an area doesn't have LIDAR doesn't mean the existing process can't screen. We still have air photos. We still have other tools, and as Stephen pointed out, we still have boots on the ground. So I don't want to leave the board with the impression that there's gaping holes here. However, there are things here that we can do to help us do our job more efficiently and more accurately, and that's, I think, the important point. Is that fair?
Very fair.
Board Member Lord.
Thanks for the presentation. This is very interesting. The chart is very handy. I'm thinking about public access, and you've had this column here talking about who can get this information, even though it's quite technical. I'm not sure how accessible it is once you get to it. But I wonder if there's a page at DNR where you have essentially a chart like this, kind of a one-stop place to find out where to get the data, and, or if that's in the works.
I think we'll have to get back to you on that. I'm not exactly sure if we have something like that or not, but we can get some people to check on that for you.
I see that many of the sites really are on DNR, but if you have to hunt for them or piece them together, it'd be much more convenient.
Is that a public clearinghouse?
Yeah, type? Kind of. Function.
So the landslide database line, on this, which is on the back side of the second page, is first one at the top of the page, was a project that the DNR Geology Division initiated to serve in that type of a capacity. It does contain some of the other data points that are on the sheet, but it was a funding constrained project and got so far. For example, the issues with stereo photos, unless I miss my guess, is that in order to actually use those, you need to have a physical copy. You need to have a stereo pair and put it in a stereo viewer. It's not so much something that you can pull up on a monitor, although the last item on the list is it's 3D imagery, basically, which isn't quite as good as a stereo pair, but is intended, I think, to serve the same purpose.
It's kind of a GIS, or you can download ortho photos and you could probably print them off in a similar way if you knew what you were doing. So there's some ways to kind of get around that. Technology is becoming more available, but certainly the older school of just stereo photos is kind of more restricted access. So.
We may cover this in more depth later, but you mentioned that you're looking at the LIDAR coverage. We have a map. It's in the August 25th letter from Mark Engel that shows LIDAR coverage. Do we think we have, or do we know we have complete coverage in these areas that are shown in yellow, like for the entire area, or are there gaps? And are we identifying those?
I think it's going to be talked about a little bit later. Okay. But this should be a pretty comprehensive, where this is probably out of the LIDAR consortium along with some poly DNR data. This is probably the vast majority of this is probably accessible to the public through the LIDAR consortium.
Yeah, I can ask later because I've looked at that material and it's a little hard to piece together. They don't kind of put it all in one place for you, so thank you for doing this. But the other question is, we talked, I think, last meeting about working or trying to work with DOT and Forest Service and other public agencies in terms of. We talked about trying to work with other agencies that might have needs for similar types of information, like WSDOT is a good example. Federal agencies, USGS, and things like that. Has that been part of the conversation, or are we really focused inward at this point?
So initially, I think it's fair to say we're looking at places where, you know, really the consortium is the primary focus, because it's not perhaps organized and accessible, it is physically in one place. You can go to one point and get it. As landowners have begun to look at questions of LIDAR availability, I think we're discovering that there are lots of LIDAR sources and bits and pieces associated with other land managers that are not part of the consortium. And so while we haven't really talked about it in any great detail within the technical group or within policy yet, I could easily envision some sort of recommendation around sort of expanding the sort of search for publicly available LIDAR outside of the consortium. It is out there. It's not easily found, because often it's sort of a project-specific flight, for example, and if it happens to be against your property, then you can get that, you know, available. But bringing that stuff out into an aggregated place is I think, you know, one of the key tasks that we'll work.
Probably a more appropriate question for DNR than it is for policy.
Yeah, thanks. Board Member Sweeney.
So The existence of the stereo pair photos, you talked about DNR having access to that, or DNR being the housing entity for that, and the public having kind of a hard time getting that. So my questions are, does DNR have coverage for the whole state? I mean, are there any gaps in the existence of those tools as a backup to where you don't have LiDAR? And then my second question is, do landowners either have their own set? I mean, landowners who regularly, you know, do timber harvest, can they either get access to it relatively easily at DNR, or do they have their own sets?
So DNR is one agency that would have aerial photo library. Universities often have some amount of collections in other public agencies. So like on this list here, it's a, you know, limited public access through various places. We do have a more or less statewide air photo collection in DNR. I didn't really repeat some of that question.
What I'm getting at is that, so if DNR has access to that, I'm assuming that the process review that you guys do for FPAs that was sort of talked about in the first part of the presentation, you know, so where there's not LiDAR or in concert with LiDAR, DNR can use those tools for screening because DNR staff has access to that. But, you know, an important part of that, of these forms, is that landowners fill out this information. And so for the places where LiDAR is absent, I'm wondering about how, you know, timber operators can access this tool in the absence of LiDAR.
So I think what I heard Isabel say was that DNR's got pretty broad air photo coverage, and you know, I think some practicing qualified experts probably can navigate their way into that and access that. The flights exist, and often landowners can simply purchase that information. Sometimes they will fly their own for a variety of reasons. Or simply try to access it through public means. Also, the qualified experts themselves, if it's a contracting geologist, for example, can simply purchase the pairs they need. So I think the information's there. It's just, you know, we sort of realized in our conversations, it's not a one-stop shop in terms of you know, landowner access, public access, but the data is theoretically available for either use, you know, through DNR or for purchase. Board Member Lauren.
Thank you. One of the tools you list here, and probably the most important tool, ultimately, are the geotechnical reports. And I'd like to understand a little bit more how those are generated. I'm really interested in the role of the private landowner, what part they do related to this, or how much of the geotechnical reports come from there, and then what DNR looks at. And I guess fundamentally I'm wondering if we have enough resources at DNR in this area.
So there's a presentation later today at the implementation of DNR steps to apply additional scrutiny of unstable slopes applications. That's going to cover a lot of that in that talk how DNR does that.
I think maybe we can tee up Kurt here and progress.
So why don't I, while we move Kurt's first PowerPoint presentation up. Got it. And so the first, you know, maybe to set the context while Kurt's getting warmed up here, is there's a board recommendation looking at the evaluation of existing mitigation measures under current rule pertaining to groundwater recharge areas associated with glacial deep-seated landslides. And I think it's important, for the board to understand that, you know, what is actually in rule sets up a process to identify mitigation measures. And maybe the first way to think about this is that, you know, at first pass, you know, your first, I hesitate to use the term mitigation, but really the first pass is avoidance. In other words, if you've identified the feature, simply staying, keeping your operations away, sufficiently away where they won't influence that feature is sort of, you know, the sort of default approach. And that would indicate that your application would be classified as a Class 3 forest application and would proceed through that process. You know, the new piece in that form would actually, though, require that landowners disclose where those features are. In the past, I might just have a polygon that moves around a feature, and it may not have been identified as part of the application. I'm outside of it, it's okay, but the reviewers may not know that whether that's, you know, a clear cut or a groundwater recharge area. And so that's, I think, an important piece of where those comes together for mitigate or avoidance. If a landowner decides that they need to conduct operation on those features, it puts them into the Class 4 special category. And there's, you know, a process by which mitigation measures are actually identified. Generally, they're very specific to the feature and to the operation. And that's a big part of what I think Kurt's going to be presenting, is give you an idea of kind of what the range of things that are out there. This is one of those pieces where what we're doing is sort of going through FPAs and looking at different mitigations and really thinking about how we're going to present that formally to the board in terms of, you know, addressing that particular motion. So this is, again, very much a work in progress, but I think we're far enough along to be able to share some of the things we're seeing and hopefully get some feedback if we're addressing that board motion appropriately.
Okay, thanks. What you're going to be seeing here is a brief progress report on the work of the policy subgroup that's looking at the different mitigation, a couple of different mitigation strategies. One of those is watershed analysis prescriptions, and then the second one is the processing of forest practice applications, as Board Member Lori was asking for more information about. And then we'll also talk about the research strategy, and I'm assuming you guys will want to do some setup for that. Okay, so we'll continue with this. This is, again, work in progress, so we're just trying to show you what we've been doing and kind of what we're finding at this point. Okay, watershed analysis, as most of you are well aware, was a very active part of forest practices that mostly was conducted in the 1990s prior to the forest and fish era. In watershed analyses, there were prescriptions and resource sensitivities identified related to mass wasting, depending on what was occurring in that particular watershed. So what the goal of our exercise in our subgroup was to look back into some of these watershed analysis prescriptions and see if there were mitigations that had been overlooked or maybe had some broader application. And so what we did is we looked at the 52 approved watershed analysis documents that were housed on the DNR website, which of course made them very accessible, which was nice. It should be noted that most of these have expired as regulatory documents, but still, obviously, a lot of work went into these, and I think there's some value in seeing what those watershed analysis teams came up with as ways to address some of these issues that are still relevant today. So one thing to keep in mind, of course, is that watershed analyses were done prior to forest and fish, and therefore they were done before there was a groundwater recharge area or glacial deep-seated rule in the forest practice rule book. And in each of these watersheds, the technical and prescription team was focusing on the history in that particular watershed. So it was based on the landslide occurrence that had happened there. So it was really specific to that location, which of course gave it the benefit of being site specific, but it also gave it the limitation of not being designed to cover a broader area outside of that area, including other parts of the state. So these are localized prescriptions that we were reviewing. And it should be noted that Most and perhaps all of the watershed analyses we looked at did have prescriptions for deep-seated landslides, but only a subset of those had any focus on glacial deep-seateds in glacial materials or focusing on groundwater recharge areas. So we kind of focused in on the subset. Out of the 52 watersheds that we started with, 22 were determined to be within parts of the state that are that were glaciated and thus have the right geologic history to be relevant to the glacial issue. Out of those, 6 out of those 22 had prescriptions that either dealt with glacial deep-seated landslides or dealt with the groundwater recharge area. The rest of those simply had prescriptions for deep-seated landslides in generally non-glacial materials, and so those were considered to be not particularly relevant. And as I mentioned before, all of the watershed prescriptions I looked at are not currently in effect as regulatory tools, but still we believe have some value. So as far as giving you kind of an overview of what these prescriptions look like, some of these all of them had prescriptions for the active landslide itself, the area where the ground is moving, and you know there's no question that you're on a landslide. The groundwater recharge area was addressed in a smaller group of those 6 watershed analyses. And as far as the prescriptions go on active landslides, all of the 6 required preventing new roads and timber harvest on the active landslide. In a couple of those cases, there were options where a proponent or landowner could have a localized geotechnical report that might allow or justify certain specific prescriptions. As far as the groundwater recharge area, 3 out of those 6 had prescriptions that addressed activities within the groundwater recharge area. So they were sort of anticipating the rule that came into effect after the Forest and Fish Agreement. And as far as all these 3 where restrictions were present, they involved requirements to either leave a buffer outside of the active landslide or to harvest only a percentage of the groundwater recharge, with in some cases a couple different options. One thing that was a little bit interesting to me was that all 6 of these addressed the concern of whether forest roads could contribute to movement of deep-seated landslides through the routing of water through road drainage. And so all 6 of these had requirements to identify places where roads were possibly contributing to drainage issues. So just to wrap up what we found from these watershed analysis prescriptions, relatively few of those addressed glacial deep-seateds per se in the understanding that we have now, that they are restricted to that particular geologic setting, and few also applied to recharge areas. All of these prescriptions focused on mitigation through controlling changes to the water input. So all the different teams were sort of approaching the impact, the potential management impacts in a similar technical way. And in most cases, the approach they took was to restrict harvest or new roads on active landslides, in some cases to reduce or mitigate possible impacts on groundwater recharge areas. And finally, the issues related to forest roads and groundwater recharge areas was a focal point in all of these. So this is how folks approached this issue in the 1990s. This is a good point for questions on this watershed analysis review.
Questions from board members? And are we next
part is forest practice application
around mitigation. Okay, maybe we'll come back to it at the end.
Okay.
I have a quick question.
Okay.
Did were any of these watershed analysis prescriptions followed up on in terms of their effectiveness? Did anybody go back and look to see if these prescriptions actually prevented additional landslide activity?
That's a great question, and unfortunately,
We weren't able to assess that because the documentation wasn't readily available. So that might be something somebody could look into. My guess is you might not find very much, but it might be worth confirming that. Yeah, it could be incorporated as far as the research strategy would be to follow up on that. Stephen's point.
Board Member Somerset. Yeah, part of the watershed analysis process was to do some sort of review over time of the prescriptions and how they were working. And I think maybe the process didn't last long enough. Some of the analyses were renewed, but not very many of them. But that was sort of an inherent part of the process. It was supposed to be a review over time. I just don't think it lasted long enough in most cases.
If you recall, once we negotiated the forest and fish agreement, it sort of took the air out of the watershed analysis balloon to do more. And so those prescriptions remain in place, and the requirement to do five-year reviews, for example, sort of went by the wayside until we updated the watershed analysis rule several years ago as a result of the 2006-07 storm. However, there are a couple of landowners that watershed analysis is part of their HCPs, and those couple of landowners continue to update their watershed analysis. But those one of those landowners in particular are not in glaciated area. The other, I'm not sure. Can you address that? Can you?
Yeah, I believe we still need to confirm the remaining landowner, but our initial pass of the three. Four actually landowners who are either have watershed analysis as part of their habitat conservation plans or are electing to do the five-year review to keep those prescriptions alive. Three out of the four are not in areas of glaciation, and we're fairly certain the fourth is not as well, but we're in the process of confirming that with that landowner.
So Kurt, part of the watershed analysis process was there was sort of a standard level one analysis that was a little broader brush, higher elevation, lower resolution of information. Then there was a level two analysis where any of these level two, where you could actually sort of tailor a much more in-depth analysis of a particular problem area. Did you look at that?
I believe several of these were level two analyses, which really indicates the level of analytical effort that went into those and the amount of field effort that was done. I guess you and I were both probably involved in some of those in the past, so we're having to remember kind of how things were done. But the level one was designed to be mostly a remote exercise, more of an office type of analysis. And I think most of these were level two. In fact, level two ended up becoming kind of the standard approach because the level one was not really very satisfying as far as providing a strong, confident answer to some of these things. So as far as what the prescriptions were, another thing that's probably worth noting is that one of the analyses that was among those six was the Hazel, which includes the Oso landslide. So that was an example where the issue related to glacial deep-seated landslides was well recognized at that time because of the history, including the Hazel or Oso landslide. In that case, the prescription had to do with monitoring any kind of activity that was going to be conducted in that area. So there were some prescriptions that were more analytical rather than prescriptive or more diagnostic.
Yeah, and just for the board too, I spent my life doing this in the 90s, creating watershed analysis with Kurt, Steve, and
Nancy
in the back. But the idea of targeting areas that we've got a lot of unknowns or complex situations and really drilling down and focusing on those areas, I think was a useful one that we agencies, tribes, industry agreed, you know, if we can focus this in the real problem areas, it's a useful technique and thing to do. And we may have lost that with watershed analysis a little bit. We might want to consider how that sort of approach to the affordance.
The other thing, if I might add, we learned a lot during the length of watershed analysis. The first couple of watershed analyses, we sort of painted unstable slopes areas red and said, oh, we need to go back there and do a further analysis. And by the time that watershed analysis sort of ran out of steam, all the geologic or the mass wasting map units, as we used to call them, were very, very detailed and very prescriptive, prescriptively addressed compared to the early ones.
Discussion before we move on to the next part of the presentation.
Okay. This will be fairly brief because this this piece of our analysis is still pretty much a work in progress. This is the task that we're undertaking to look at the as many of the forest practice applications that have involved glacial deep-seated landslides and groundwater recharge areas from the last 15 years or so. So this is a kind of a brief look at where we are so far. 45 permits have been collected that involved these two issues. They were collected, they're being compiled by the WFPA, and they're getting input from landowners, DNR staff, as well as tribal reviewers. So all those different organizations have gone through their files and found some of these to contribute to the analysis. Probably not finding every single one, but there's a pretty good pool that's built up. Of the ones that that we have in hand, they span the years from 2003 until the present. They are not distributed across DNR regions equally, as you might guess. The bulk, 60%, were from the Northwest region, and the remainder were split between the South Puget and Olympic regions, which of course is fits very nicely with where we know that the glacial conditions are suitable for this type of landslide. Of those, two-thirds of those were processed as Class 4 and the remainder as Class 3 applications. And then as far as the additional work, which is really where things get more interesting, that is still being done, and there's not much we can say at this point. The group is going to be reviewing the permits and also the associated geotech reports. The preliminary work indicates that there's a pretty wide variety of technical and procedural issues that are being discussed in these reports. So it's been a challenge to sort of lump these into categories or say things about one type or another. So that's the upcoming challenge. And they hope to bin these according to mitigation strategy and also things such as the potential for resource or public safety issues, the magnitude of overlap with the groundwater recharge area, and a couple fairly reasonable types of things. So that is that's a work in progress at this point, but accumulating the permits was a pretty big challenge, and that's pretty much behind us. So that's where we're at with forest practice applications.
So maybe I could add, because this is I think a point where it would be helpful to have a little bit of board input. You know, as we're sort of looking into the range of mitigations, we're realizing and perhaps should have out of the onset that these often are very specific because they're dealing with a specific project, a specific proposed activity, and a specific feature. And so we're gonna do our best shot to try to sort of, you know, as Kurt said, bin these into various categories so that we can present some generalizations to the board to be able to show kind of the range of mitigation measures that are out there. And I'm at least initially sort of advising the technical group as they're thinking about this to think about it in terms of a continuum. And we may have different continuums. We may be looking at a range, you know, we may look at a range of intensity of activity
and look at prescriptions there. We might also look, flip it around and look at the range of activity of the feature and what kind of mitigation measures are associated with that. So we'll be able to come at this information in a couple of different ways, but I wanted to make sure the board understands that this isn't going to be a neat orderly, you know, there's, you know, six of these and eight of these kind of things that could be sort of put together. But I think we'll be able to describe very well the kind of range of mitigations you might expect under a set of conditions.
You mentioned binning the mitigation approaches in some way. Do you have a sense of what those buckets broadly might look like? Maybe that'll help us.
I think slide activity level is probably one. I think they're kind of sort of broadly described there. Whether you could look at mitigation strategy. In other words, did you just avoid it, or did you choose to operate on it? If you chose to operate on it, was it simply, putting a road through it, or was it, some more intense, proposal of harvest, or was it a thinning, or was it a piece of it? And so you can see things like that. My thinking has been a lot more driven towards the sort of different kinds of features. As I've learned about these features, not all glacial deep-seated landslides are equal. And they're both in terms of their size and their activity level. And so the implication of management on the groundwater recharge area can change based on activity level, can be based on stratigraphy, the underlying geologic makeup of the feature. And so there may be other ways to look at that. The question is, you can sort of move these around and bin these, and, does it tell a story? We're not really sure yet. Did that help, Aaron?
It begins to. Maybe mitigation is a. We were focused on applications that do something other than avoid.
Right.
Altogether.
Yep.
And so, I think classifying the features is helpful to us because it helps us understand appropriate corresponding mitigation course, depending on what the nature of the actual feature is. I think we all struggle a bit with sort of quantifying the assumptions in the mitigation strategies and understanding the level of certainty that we're working with around those mitigation strategies. And that's probably perhaps something that can be gleaned from geotechnical reports on those applications, as far as what methods were used and how certain in those instances we feel like those calls were. And again, this sort of comes back to sort of major tasks the board is assigned around. What are the methods for doing delineation? How certain can we be about the methods? How contemporary are those in terms of scientific and field method? And so, not to mix the tasks too much, but it would be helpful to me at least, and maybe have a discussion about this, to in some way correlate the methodology, the certainty of the mitigation measures with the approach that was taken. That makes sense. But Board Member Lauren.
Yeah, thank you for that. I thinking kind of along the same lines as, okay, what does this get us? I was just looking at the board motion that you're responding to, and I appreciate all this great work. We asked for an evaluation of existing mitigation measures, and the way you're presenting this, it's going to be very hard to, I'm not sure what evaluation means in the context, because they're all so specific. But the board chair just provided a little more context there, talking about, has this led to certainty? I guess what I'm struggling with is you may have to interpret our our motion a bit to make sense given what you're looking at here. So I think the sorting, as you say, is going to be useful. It's going to be instructive, but we're also looking for something a little bit more than that. And I know other board members may have some ideas on how to help direct you at this point. It seems like a very good check-in right now as we're learning about this. But so certainty has something. Well, I see some other folks.
Oh, go ahead.
So let's finish.
I'm sorry. I'm just...
No, that's good. That's good.
So on that, in the same line, one obvious thing in mitigation is the prescription. What are they recommending you do or don't do? The other is the tools used to, you know, identify the feature. Especially, I think we're struggling with groundwater recharge zones, and how do you even delineate them or understand where they are? So it may not lend itself to a statistical analysis, but flagging, you know, sort of what tools and methods or how that was handled would, I think, would be useful. And any discussions or addressing of the uncertainty and kind of recommendations around that, I think those would all be useful pieces of information. And they may just be nothing more than flagging them so we can understand kind of people's thinking. But those two area prescriptions and then the tools, I think, make sense to me. It's all part of mitigation.
And I, just building on this, I want to see, I want to understand pretty clearly the circumstances under which the mitigation was anything other than avoidance altogether.
I think, you know, sort of responding generically to that, you know, I think you'll see activity level of the actual feature being a significant variable. And that's why I was suggesting the binning in that kind of regard. And that's sort of an anecdotal observation. But I completely appreciate the idea of moving from simply a bidding exercise into actually saying, okay, the so what? And these comments are very helpful, I think, in being able to extract the kinds of things. Because what we wanted to do is avoid a laundry list of mitigations and justifications that went along with that. And so we were hoping to be able to group some of this. But we may end up there, you know, in some form. But I think that what we might find is that there may be multiple similar rationales across a wide degree of different features, and that may provide, you know, a little bit more help into this discussion. But that's exactly the feedback loop, which I really appreciate that.
Just to be clear, when he talks about activity, you may have a deep-seated landslide that is completely dormant, and you may have a set of mitigation measures that were approved instead of avoidance in that case, because there was no sense, as opposed to something like the Hazel landslide where there was activity ongoing.
So this may just be reiterating what's already been said, but just to put a fine point, I would especially be interested in prescriptions that were, you know, kind of like in the watershed analysis, trying to prevent additional water going, you know, through the groundwater recharge area into the glacial deep-seated landslide. And I know that there's not enough time to do like a thorough scientific effectiveness analysis, but any information or judgment about, you know, by today's standards, would those mitigation measures have been considered adequate? And, you know, because this is all, and the whole point of this is a learning exercise to, you know, what do we do going forward? You know, so how does it compare to what's being, you know, learned in board manual development or updating? You know, how effective are those prescriptions at not increasing risk, you know, based on flow of groundwater? And then, you know, are those approaches still adequate given, you know, this likely prediction that we're going to have more moisture over time given climate change? Those would be general things I'd be interested in knowing, and I understand it may be not quite possible to get that from all the information you have, but I think that's sort of a target going forward is, you know, we're doing this as a learning exercise to figure out how to be more effective going forward.
I think that's an excellent segue into the research strategy conversation, but we're
okay there. Board Member Stanley?
Just one more, just a suggestion, and I think you brought it up, Stephen, is there's going to be a huge difference, or seen the difference, between prescriptions on an active slide versus an ancient, and seeing the difference on both and how they were applied. It seems like that would be kind of an interesting way to sort it.
I had one more comment. I just think it's important to to calibrate expectations here a little bit. I mean, we have 45 permits. Each of these has, well, a lot of these have a geotech report that has a lot of information in it. They're unique situations. And then the main problem is what we talked about before is as far as what was whether it was effective or not, we really have no way of knowing that without revisiting these sites, at least remotely. So it's a paper exercise at this point. And it's also, because of the number of permits we have, it's too many to really talk about each one individually, but it's not a big population either. I think a lot of these, from what I've seen, the report really deals with, you know, should this be considered a glacial deep sea landslide? Is it maybe borderline cases, or where is the groundwater recharge? There's a lot of challenges just as far as knowing whether you're on it or not that are not going anywhere near the kinds of should we go in there and how many trees and what kind of techniques do we use to justify it. A lot of those never got to that point. They really focused on definition issues. So it's important to realize that we can only go so far with this.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm struggling with here is, and maybe it's just because of my own ignorance, but understanding how a groundwater recharge area is delineated through the forest practice rules. For me, having that understanding is critical to looking and trying to get a sense of confidence as are these the correct mitigation measures to be used. So maybe it's just a personal thing from me, but I would certainly like to know more about the process of delineation and how that's done.
I think we'll spend an awful lot of time in the board manual here in the next agenda item. So we'll continue to go into depth on that. Do you want to transition to the research strategy?
Yes.
For the closing piece of this?
Yeah, so again, this is sort of shifting back to perhaps a more traditional role for PFW policy. I think you're all familiar, obviously, with the adaptive management program, and we have a CEMER work plan that has an unstable slopes sort of group of projects. A subset of those is related to glacial deep-seated landslides. And, again, independent of the Hazel slide, we were already headed down a path of reviewing our mass wasting strategy, research strategy more broadly as part of the response to the mass wasting effectiveness monitoring program. What we've done is essentially prioritize the glacial deep-seated piece of that review on the front end. And that's consisted with, the technical group taking a quick look at kind of what's in the work plan and sort of, at a cursory level, sort of looking at, okay, does that plan still make sense? If yes, what are priorities? If not, what are alternatives? This is something that, traditionally we don't simply just throw together a technical group. This goes through, our CEMER process. And how we're setting this up is to really kind of get a first pass at that with the technical group and a first pass at that with policy so we can get some idea of what the direction is, begin to look at funding and things like that, so we can begin to sort of front load the work that will really come when we move this from the technical group into the scientific advisory group that would be tasked with fully flushing out research options and then on to CEMER and then on to policy. So I'd be remiss if I didn't underscore the point that this is the information you're going to get here is the group of three or four really smart people, but it hasn't gone through our process yet. But I think it's cooked enough where we're comfortable sort of daylighting that. So that's my caveat.
Okay.
we're going to, this is going to be a longer presentation than the previous one that's going to provide a lot of background and some history as far as where the adaptive management program has been on this topic over the last decade and a half. So this is Stephen encouraged me to dust off a presentation that was developed about 6 years ago. The last time this issue came to the forefront of the CMER world. And so we'll talk about that a bit, which will include some technical background that's still relevant, and then wrap up with some updated thinking that's been done in the last month since the board requests have come to us. So away we go. The initial presentation, which is with the blue dark blue background, is the product of the UPSAG, which stands for the Upslope Processes Science Advisory Group, which is a technical subgroup of CMER, which I'm assuming you all have a general understanding of how CMER provides science for policy, et cetera. So the SAGs, just to remember, are subgroups that are responsible for designing and conducting research projects. And they also create the work plan, which becomes the communication tool by which the rest of the program understands where folks are headed. In this case, the UPSAG is the SAG that deals with topics involving hill slopes, roads, and stream channels. Folks in that group have expertise in geology, hydrology, as well as engineering, forestry, statistics, and some other things. The thing to be aware of, besides the fact that they that this SAG has membership from the different stakeholder groups, is that most of the folks that have been involved in this are scientists, but they're field scientists that deal with FPA review, and they write geotech reports, and are really involved at the ground level. They go on ID teams. So these are folks that have both the scientific understanding as well as the working knowledge of how the rules are being dealt with and where the challenges are. So I was fortunate enough to be part of that group myself. What I'll talk to you about right now is a little bit of a review of the rule and background of the groundwater recharge rule. Talk about the work that we did in 2007 to review the work plan at that time, and then the recommendations from that particular time. So we'll cruise through this stuff. There's a lot of information. Hopefully a lot of it is review. It might be too much, it might be too little, but I'll just run through what I have. The groundwater recharge rule, as many of you are probably well aware, involves the application of a class 4 special category that requires a CEPA review. The language talks about the potential to deliver sediment or debris to public resources or that has the potential to threaten public safety. So this is a review, I'm sure. And then one of the categories of unstable slopes is this item number C, which are groundwater recharge areas for glacial deep-seated landslides. So that's the rule trigger associated with this. Groundwater recharge areas, to respond to a recent question, the groundwater recharge area is the land upgradient that contributes subsurface water to a deep-seated landslide in glacial sediments. In the diagram, you can see this is a cartoon that really reflects the typical situation in glacial sediments, where we have the land surface up here, a permeable material, sand or gravel, something that the water flows through easily, sitting on top of a less permeable material, a till or a clay layer. Classically, and then the water that soaks into the ground here drains out depending on what the contours are and the topography and where the water tends to want to move. In this case, the groundwater recharge area extends up to this subtle ridge top because the interpretation would be that the water coming in here would flow into this landslide. The water on this other side of this ridge would be flowing into somewhere else where we're assuming doesn't have the same issue. So this is kind of what the classic glacial landslide recharge area scenario looks like. And more groundwater recharge 101. Why do we have the rule? Well, obviously, we can have some severe aquatic resource impacts, and in some cases, public safety impacts. So this is pretty straightforward. It's worth knowing that not all parts of the state are subject to this particular process. We're primarily looking at areas under white where we had continental or alpine glaciation. So this shows that it's concentrated in the northern and more mountainous parts of the state. And the reason that we have these glacial terraces that are prone to this type of landsliding is what happened following the retreat of the glaciers, in which valleys were filled with glacial sediment, alluvial sediments such as this, and then as that downcut, it left these high terraces, which were unstable and prone to erosion through mass wasting and other kinds of erosion processes. Another diagram showing how this can work in cases where the glacial sediments, the layers here shown in blue and white, sometimes are sitting on top of bedrock, and that can be sometimes the surface by which the moisture gets routed into the landslide. So it can be fairly complicated or fairly straightforward depending on the history and how material was laid down in that location. So the thing that makes this a really difficult issue in a regulatory context is it's a very difficult issue from a scientific standpoint. And that there's a whole bunch of interconnected processes and pieces that all play out as far as whether management can affect a given landslide. So just to follow the trail of water, at the sort of upstream end of this process, timber harvest reduces the amount of water that trees pump out of the soil, which we use the term evapotranspiration, a 26-cent hydrology term that talks about the way that water is sidetracked by trees, which reduces the amount of it that soaks into the soil. So anyway, this becomes an issue when this additional moisture flows into the landslide, which can lead to greater amounts of water and saturation within the soil. And then what happens in some cases is that the greater amount of saturation increases both the weight of the soil with the water and also pore pressure, the flotation created by the saturated areas. And then in some cases, this can lead to accelerated landslide movement. So you need to have all four of these links working together to lead to this effect that we're here to discuss today. So this becomes a challenge scientifically because, as I mentioned, we need to look at the effect of the canopy loss. We also need to understand how the groundwater process is operating and have some understanding of what's going on in the hill slope to know whether it even makes a difference. And all these things are fairly non-generic. They vary from place to place. You can stand on top of the ground and not see most of these things that are happening beneath your feet somewhere down below the surface. We have other things going on in most of these cases. We have river undercutting. We have questions as far as how far slow movement would move across the land below. So there's a whole bunch of things going on here that make this a hard thing to sort out. And as a result, this is why there's been a general understanding that these things really require case-by-case evaluation. So now another level of challenge comes to the application of forest practice rules. Levels of landslide activity, how active, is a dormant landslide subject to these rules or not? Also, there's a wide range of glacial materials. There's till, that's like a hardpan type of material that some of you have probably seen before. In some cases, you have pure sand or gravel that both behave very differently hydrologically. So there's a bunch of different variables that come into play as far as deciding what areas are vulnerable to this issue and where the rule applies. And then the groundwater recharge area adds another another challenge as far as the fact that you can be in a recharge area and see no evidence of instability, because the recharge area by definition is not unstable. It's the area that's hydrologically connected to the unstable area. And sometimes groundwater recharge areas can extend far upslope depending on the topography. And as we talked, as Isabel talked about before, some deep-seated landslides are mapped and accessible, and many of them are not. And the groundwater recharge areas are rarely mapped. So generally, we don't have a lot of information to begin our work with. Here's a diagram of what a groundwater recharge area looks like. This, in this diagram, this is the Hazel landslide here in red, towing into the Stillaguamish River. The groundwater recharge area is this area surrounded by blue dots where the topography suggests that groundwater would be flowing into the landslide. And just to give you a scenario, the black line is an example of what a landowner may have interest in harvesting trees on. And in this case, the groundwater recharge area issue is focused on the overlap between the black polygon and the groundwater recharge area, just this little area here, because the other parts of the proposal are outside of the groundwater recharge area for that landslide. They might be for another landslide, but in this case, they're draining to other parts of the topography. So typically, once this situation is identified on the ground, the next step is some sort of a geotechnical analysis. And there's a variety of different techniques and strategies that have been used depending on what the geologist feels is appropriate. Aerial photos, field work, in some cases modeling, potentially even drilling to monitor groundwater, those kinds of things. So there's kind of a very broad range of different intensities and techniques that can be brought into this question. And modeling, of course, is a wonderful tool, but it brings with it a lot of assumptions. So it's always important to realize the more sophisticated the analysis, usually the more question marks and uncertainties are required to bring that into the conversation. So now we move on to the research strategy, which is kind of the main topic here. There is some history of at CEMER and UPSAG of looking at groundwater recharge area as in deep-seated, glacial deep-seated landslides, beginning in 1998 with the Forest and Fish discussions. This issue was identified as a research topic on the Schedule L1, which basically lists a whole variety of research needs that were identified at that time. In 2000, when UPSAG was initiated, the very first project that group did was a groundwater or evapotranspiration modeling project, which was initiated then. And then in 2006, this issue was raised because of difficulties in implementing the groundwater recharge rule. DNR had raised some questions that they thought were potentially important to adaptive management and wanted to see some work being done on those things, and that led to the effort in 2007 to sort of scope out some possible projects or get a better handle on what some of the uncertainties were and what direction could be pursued. At that point, that also corresponded to with the occurrence of the Chehalis flood, which basically created a major focus on mass wasting, but it focused on shallow landslides in southwest Washington. So basically, the folks that were involved in scoping the groundwater recharge area were absorbed in a multi-year study of the prescription effectiveness, which you all are familiar with. So essentially, that sucked away a lot of the available expertise and UPSAG resources into a different type of mass wasting. So the work that was done prior to the Chehalis flood on this involved scoping of some potential projects, in which UPSAG worked with geology contractors to identify three possible studies for consideration. The contractors developed scoping papers, some estimates of time and budgets, and those were reviewed by UPSAG and presented at the CEMER Science Conference. So the projects, I'll run through these quickly because in some extent they're obsolete at this point, but it's just to give you some background on what was being seen as the direction as of 2007. One of them was to continue modeling of evaporative transpiration and trying to improve available models to better understand how the loss of forest canopy due to logging, to quantify how much water would be affected. Secondly, there was a project envisioned to better understand groundwater recharge areas. And finally, a concept of coming up with a better way to classify different types of glacial deep-seated landslides to try to understand which of those were more or less sensitive to management effects. So those were the three finalists on that from that effort. Just to flesh those out a little bit more, the modeling project was envisioned as being something that would cost on the order of $55,000 to improve tools. The idea being that if we had better modeling tools, these could become the standard technique for use in geotechnical reports so that there was a general understanding within the forest and fish community of kind of how you would approach these and what the appropriate tools were. The problem with this approach is that you can understand evapotranspiration quite well, but it doesn't really tell you where the water is going and what the slope is going to do in response to a certain amount of water. So it just focuses a lot of energy on one piece of that question. The second study idea was this idea of trying to improve our understanding of groundwater recharge areas, and in some cases maybe making an attempt to understand whether certain parts of the groundwater recharge area were better connected to the unstable slope or not. So this was something that was explored. It had a similar budget, around $55,000, to try to understand what parts of the groundwater recharge area were needed to be focused on. One of the limitations of this study as something to pursue was that we would need to improve the evapotranspiration model. So it's sort of a follow-up to the previous. It would be phase two. And I think there was some uncertainty on whether this would really be a viable route to really improve the regulation of these features. Now, the third project was this idea of an improved approach for landslide classification. The thinking there being that we know for a fact that all deep-seated landslides are not created alike, that they behave differently, have different history, response to different types of hydrologic events. They're composed of different kinds of glacial materials. Maybe there's ways to put these into different categories, as some being insensitive and some being highly sensitive, thereby being able to really improve the regulation and to have a common understanding of which types of glacial landslides are greatest interest. And that was something that was had a pretty broad possible budget on the order of $100,000 to $200,000 is what the group had thought at that time, because it was sort of a little bit of a placeholder in that it would require additional thinking just to decide how to do this. It seemed like a promising idea, but one that needed more focus to understand exactly how and how much much it would require to pursue this. So at that time, UPSAG came away without a whole lot of, they didn't really see a good pathway to focusing resources and getting practical information to the table within a reasonable amount of time. They were fairly pessimistic. The conclusions were that none of these scope projects would really reduce scientific uncertainty. There would be, you know, it would raise as many questions as it would answer, is it kind of the common way of dealing with these complex problems. One thing that UPSAG did recognize at that time, and this is an idea that's carried into the present, is the idea that the board manual, there was room for improvement there to provide better guidance. So the other things that came out of this process was interest in further scoping the classification project when more time would have been available. In this case, the Shehala study ended up basically taking up all the time and resources up until this point. And then the thing to be well aware of at this point is that all these projects, even though none of them were considered to be a particularly good bang for the buck, they were all retained in the SEMA work plan. And many of you have probably seen some of these projects in there, and the question has been raised, well, gee, here's all these projects, how come none of these projects are being pursued? Well, the reasons were largely because there were other more urgent priorities being attended to, and secondly, of course, the resources, the financial resources for these things are substantial. So this is where we were in 2007, and as you can see, this is actually a pretty good foundation from where we are now. There's quite a bit of continuity. As far as the board manual revision approach, at that time, like I mentioned, we saw the potential to strengthen the documentation and information available there. So I'll continue forward into the work that was done in the last few months in response to the board request. Basically going back to the drawing board, seeing whether these same conclusions appear to be timely. And so what the policy subgroup did in the last month or so was to get a small working group composed of Nancy Sterhan, Julie Du, and Isabel Sarakhan, all of whom have extensive backgrounds with this issue, to review the work plan and the proposed studies and see whether there were new perspectives as far as what could or should be done. And so this is all very fresh, and again, it's very much a work in progress, and hopefully this is a good time to put this before you, just to give you a preview of where this might be headed. Typically, this kind of work would be done through UPSAG, and in this case, UPSAG is in a state of recovering from a dormant period, and so we weren't able to enlist UPSAG, although all the people involved in this have past and potentially future involvement in UPSAG. But this was done through a focus subgroup, but it has had no external review through SEMA or any other group. So the first thing that we looked at, or the group looked at, were critical questions. The previous critical question from the past versions of the work plan is simply, does harvesting of the recharge area of a glacial deep-seated landslide promote its instability? The consensus view is that this is still the relevant critical question. But it also, there was also an understanding that there needed to be some additional focus on this classification question. And so a supplemental critical question was drafted, which is, can relative levels of response to forest practices be predicted by key characteristics of glacial deep-seated landslides and their recharge areas? So this is a critical question that is focusing the effort on different types of landslides. And you will recognize this is sort of the follow-up to that classification project that was initially conceived in 2007. So the projects that the working group came up with included, number one, a literature review, and I'll talk more about these in a second. I just wanted to run through what the studies are and then provide a few more details, and then we'll wrap up. Secondly, another option would be to continue the mapping and consolidate available mapping at the statewide level of glacial slides, as Isabel mentioned earlier this morning. The third study would be to begin to develop different classes of deep-seated landslides, and finally to evaluate the sensitivity among these different classes. So this is kind of the latest thinking as far as four possible studies. I'll provide you with some initial information, which is very preliminary and approximate. So the literature review is something that has already been begun through a project by an expert panel that the DNR has convened that compiled a list of recent research papers related to glacial deep-seated landslides. But the working group didn't have time or resources available to completely review all these papers and synthesize the findings. And so this is there's a real potential to take better advantage of the recent science by putting more energy into this. And this would be something that would require a consultant, presumably, and take roughly 6 months and around $50,000. I'll point out that my perception is some of these time and budgets might be a little on the low side there.
Optimistic.
Yeah, optimistic. Thanks, Dave. Okay, so the second study is the idea, as Isabel introduced earlier, of better compiling and centralizing available mapping information on deep-sea landslides involving glacial materials. So that is something that I think everyone sees a lot of value in, making that more available to landowners and stakeholders. So that would involve a two-step project. One would be to compile existing information. That's something DNR staff could potentially do if they had resources and staff availability. And then a second step would be to fill gaps wherever they might be. Isabel's already looked into that, so we're learning more about that. We see this as possibly taking 6 months, and then of course the gap question is a little bit more uncertain what would be required and the cost for that. To do both those steps might be in the order of 100,000 or potentially less. Okay, so the third project would be to do the classification exercise by creating the different categories, and those could be distinguished based on landslide size, depth, slope gradient, for instance. All these things potentially could lead to ways of bidding landslides by their sensitivity. And this would potentially be done by a consultant and possibly be done in 6 months for $75,000. And finally, this is kind of the second phase of that third project, would be to actually evaluate the sensitivity of the different landslide classes by looking at the history of some of these different landslide types using primarily aerial photos and with some field work. And that would be a consulting project. It would take roughly a year and around $200,000. These are very approximate things that were generated very recently, so keep that with a grain of salt. That's where we're at with that.
Remind the board that when you adopted the master project schedule last month, that we do have placeholders in that schedule to actually take on some of this work.
Yeah, can you remind the board on what is that? Those were fiscal 15.
I believe it was starting in 15 and going out 3 or 4 years, about 100,000 each year.
And maybe while we're on the subject of budget, also recall that in the approval of the current fiscal year budget, there's allocated $50,000 for you know, an unspecified glacial deep-seated project. You know, right now, kind of where this is showing up, I think Stephen and I would be sort of recommending the policy to consider the literature review, because that's something that we could start now as opposed to later, and it could help inform, you know, UPSAG as it reconvenes. So there's a sequencing step there that makes a lot of sense. But again, that's something that we have to, you know, go through our process in terms of finalizing a recommendation like that. But that's something that I think we're thinking about.
One of the things I wanted to ask is, can we talk a little bit about the value of the mapping project versus a literature review, and what might be the most immediately useful thing to the board in its work, to the department in its work, carrying it to? It just strikes me that the mapping project has immediate utility upon its completion. It's not a, you know, further development of rural language or more manual discussion. It's a mapping project that can be used for detection type purposes. Unless I missed the...
No, I mean, you're probably on track there, and I'll ask Isabel perhaps to respond to that. But the thing that I want to point out is that that's not necessarily a research project.
but that'd be more of an operational project that DNR could conduct.
And a lot of what was proposed here for the research projects are kind of ongoing stuff. So mapping all the deep sea land sites will at least give us, for us as geologists, would probably be able to identify those regardless if we had a map or not. But that would help maybe foresters and others, landowners, know where those are on the landscape a little bit ahead of time. But for us to understand how groundwater recharge might interact with those, the rest of this research needs to be done so we know which ones are going to be the most sensitive ones, which ones are going to be less sensitive, and stuff like that. So,
at the budget and time frame for the mapping project was 56 months. Is that what I recall from the slide? Is that what it was?
100.
Want to have some more discussion about that? Board Member Guthrie?
Yeah, I really appreciate the presentation and the models that you laid out and the possibilities. But one of the questions I have is that in our present forest practices applications, if we look at class 3 and class 4, how much of the concern that you laid out is already being addressed in those applications? Is there, I have to feel that a lot of those, in those applications in the class 3 and class 4, a lot of the concern that was presented here that you might find with your research is being addressed in those classifications. Am I wrong or off base or whatever? Let me know.
Well, I think I think what you're getting at is, tell me if I'm wrong, but that the permits that involve groundwater recharge are being identified as they come in the door and being studied by a site-specific geotech report. So there's a lot of science being brought to bear on those under the present way that permits are processed. The value in doing more research would be to be able to approach some of the broader scientific uncertainties, and also to help better understanding maybe some of the gray areas or sideboards of where this rule applies. As far as I know from my own work in Northwest Washington, that there's a lot of head scratching as far as, you know, we're on this. Would this be considered a groundwater recharge zone? This is glacial till. Is this something that's not really the classic? I mean, we know what the classic is, and also the Oso landslide is the classic example. But there's a whole lot of places that have things that are much more in the gray zone, and so that would really be the value of the some of the both the literature review that might support some additional scientific work to help understand ways to categorize or come up with a more effective way to focus the available regulatory energy on the right landslides and situations. So that would be, it's kind of a big picture, small picture.
Right. Well, I appreciate the science being conducted. Don't get me wrong. I think we need to do that. But I just want to make sure that we have something in place right now that actually gives us an opportunity to identify and hopefully prevent.
So that, I mean, you're pointing out sort of the multi-pronged approach that we're taking in exploring this issue, and that's really the piece of it, you know, are we comfortable with the process? You know, are we comfortable that we've got appropriate screening tools available? Are we comfortable that we have, you know, the right expertise, both in terms of people proposing activities and in terms of people reviewing activities? And you know, what we're describing in the research kind of component is, assuming you've got that, you know, what are things we can be doing to refine that to make those jobs, you know, I hesitate to say the word easier, but perhaps maybe there are some efficiencies, or maybe we can do things with a higher degree of specificity, less uncertainty, but both are key.
So as you explained the evapotranspiration, I believe that's correct. When you explain that, I'm sitting here thinking, all right, here we are in December, we've had 20 inches of rain, how much water has those trees already absorbed, and what is their capacity to absorb more water? So I'm really appreciative of of a study, you know, to find those things out. But you just kind of wonder. We've already had 20 inches of rain, and it's December, and we get 14, 15 inches of rain in the Willapa Hills. How do we prevent that? Thank you.
And just, I think this is part of what you're doing, but in the literature study, we talked about this. I'm left feeling we've got sort of two bookends of assessment tools for groundwater recharge zones. We've got the topographic, which we all agree topography and subsurface geology can be different. It can be, it's complex. And then you've got full-scale drilling, doing borings and really understanding what's happening down below. And it seems to me there's got to be something in the middle. There's got to be some techniques that have been applied elsewhere that might give us a higher level of certainty or confidence in our topography method, but don't go to the level of, you know, having to take a drill out there and go up into borings and stuff. And so I think as we go through the literature, that would be something to look at. And this is probably not research oriented, but it affects the classification. And it was part of watershed analysis, was it kind of makes a difference how you treat a slide that might deliver to a salmon stream, or how you might treat a landslide that might deliver to a community. And you know, the resource at risk downstream sort of plays into this some level on how you treat the uncertainty. And I'm not sure if that is really CMR level policy or us, but I just wanted to throw that out there because that's kind of part of the package.
I think that's an extremely important key point, and we, you know, we've tend to focus sort of on sort of the classification piece of the rules. But remember, when you move, you know, if you find yourself in a class 4 special, you also move into the SEPA checklist part of it, and there is a more explicit requirement for addressing public safety in the rules that may get at kind of that point. But that is, you know, I think, you know, I can speak for qualified experts, is a big part of their, you know, how they factor in margins of safety and uncertainties and whatever recommendations they put forward. But that I think from a process standpoint is probably captured more on the SEPA side as opposed to the classification side. Is that fair?
Other questions, discussion on this subject? We're a few minutes past our appointed time, and there's an awful lot to cover here. Again, board members, we've got the opportunity toward the end of the day to provide further direction if you feel like that's necessary on some of the things that we've kicked around here. So we'll have a chance for folks to think about what they've heard and be able to come back to this.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. With that, we'll take a 10-minute break and be back here at 5 after.